Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Whether it's a midweek game on the continent or a big weekend clash, cash in with your soccer knowledge on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match of up to $100.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
You're listening to the Men in Blazers Media Network. Suboptimal Radio. It's Wednesday. It's Rog. Everton are falling. Life is slow dying. I actually woke up this morning and my first thought, and I imagine every single Evertonian who is listening to this podcast will probably nod knowingly, traumatically. I woke up, said to myself, hello day, what fresh new hell awaits us? Will locusts descend upon Goodison Park and devour it? Will a giant foot come down from the heavens and crush the very foundations of our new proud stadium in Bramley Dock? Worst of all, will Sam Allardyce be appointed our manager again? This is our lot. We don't know why. We don't know what we've done. What have we done in past lives for this? For us now to be living out the Book of Job. In this podcast, we've got so bloody much to discuss. Everton, obvs, and regrettably, we also have two Carabao Cup semi-finals. United glory in both. And the US men are back in action for the first time since the World Cup tonight, amidst all the chaos that has happened since. And Gio Reyna can't stop, won't stop. But first, let me say this. We are going to do it live here on AMP, and I need a hug. If you're here with us live on AMP, just come on up to the stage. Give me a hug. Give us a question on anything you want to talk about. Request to call in. We'll move you up onto the stage. You can ask me anything about Everton and their implosion, the US men and their implosion, the Carabao, and whatever implosion a Carabao implies. We can do it all. You get the drift. One note, we can only have five people up on the stage at once. So if we don't get to you, just be patient. We will get you up, I promise. And if you're not here on AMP, you're just listening live afterwards. Do you even, Bielsa? Download the app. Links all over our social. Or click the link on our social to listen live on your desktop. And you can always listen by saying, hey, Alexa, play Men in Blazers. And in case you forgot about Everton, we titled AMP, do it live. Everton in crisis, crisis, crisis. And I want to start with some happy news. Let's raise a third first bud of the day to Harry Kane, a man of whom we've talked so much, yet who arguably deserves so much more chatter and respect, because on Monday evening, with a touch, turn and blast, he slapped another record-breaking goal, the 266 of his career, drawing him level with the late, truly great Jimmy Greaves as Tottenham's all-time record scorer, an exclamation point goal to deliver an important victory, especially as Harry decides whether to sign that fresh new contract and remain a one-man, one-club legend so rare in our day, our times, or try new pastures in search of, you know, silverware. What a man, what a story, what a remarkable achiever in the face of almost constant doubt. And talking about constant doubt, to Everton. From the Florida Cup, plunging towards apocalypse, in the blink of an eye, didn't we almost have it all? No, we didn't, because we gather here today after a week of turbulence and chaos, self-sabotage and self-destruction, which has sent Everton into a dizzying tailspin. And let's be honest, these are the stakes. We are facing the prospect, very real, of our first relegation since 1951. Podcasts were not even invented then. England didn't even have electricity. It's all so real, so painful. Oh my God, this has honestly been, yesterday, possibly the worst day of my fan life. Manager gone, players clearly all want to leave. No one wants to be there. Idiot owner has destroyed the club and now has announced, now, after destroying the club, now he bloody wants to sell. Lampard gone. Club social media team reportedly read about Frank's firing in the newspapers. We had a new signing, new warm bodies, new hope. Oh, the restorative power of new signings. Restorative hope dash. Dan Juma. God, he was so new, I didn't even realise his name was not Daniel Juma. We got the here we go treatment, and he even tweeted that he was born ready. That was his tweet. Why would you join Everton Club Football Club? Because I'm born ready. And then somehow hijacked, not just hijacked, hijacked by Tottenham. He'd agreed terms with Everton, taken his medical. Sure, there's a little vial of Dan Juma blood. It's all we've got to show for it. And it's now really what it's got to. So bloody miserable that every mild happiness you just expect. No, I don't even want mild happiness now because it's going to end with me being kicked in the down belows. There's rumours of Chelsea's Hakim Ziyech signing. And I am now conditioned for something awful to happen to this move, like Chelsea hijacking their own signing. Todd Boehly will buy Ziyech for 70 million after forgetting that he already owns him. Then our best player and true elite hope, Andre Onana, who only signed for Everton on August the 10th. He's not showed up for training for the last 2 days, either for personal reasons, according to the club who are telling the press that he's, quote, gone to a wedding, or because, yeah, you hear that all the time, somebody missed training because they've gone to a wedding, or he wants to move to Chelsea or Arsenal and get away from the hellscape that is Everton Football Club, according to the English tabloids. Anthony Gordon, our star boy, he of fleeting wonder and style, United fans may remember. Adnan Yanashai once burst onto the scene like him. Anthony Gordon has scored all of 7 goals total and is now heavily linked to Newcastle. Merseyside maketh, pith taketh. We should have sold him in the summer when he was at peak value before he went blonde. Bielsa as manager. Sure, we'll talk about that today. That wonderful, insane storyline. I've actually been told he's not coming. I mean, of course he's not coming. He would have been, first of all, he takes weeks in negotiations. He is perfunctilious. This man at Leeds demanded they change the light bulb, the light switch positions to save energy as people walked around. I mean, this is a micro detail man. He doesn't just leap into melting down clubs and be like, yeah, fancy bit of this. And also would have been a stupid choice, really, of fan fiction. Dude needs weeks to get the entire culture of the club and the trainings to his exact specifications. Can you imagine this? Shut your eyes and imagine Dominic Calvert-Lewin, Big Dom, still reeling after the death of Vivian Westwood, ace designer, just devastated Dom, never really recovered. Just imagine Dom getting into the murder ball of Bielsa, the murder ball strategy. Yep, that really works. Let's put it this way. Bielsa, an incredible human being, a remarkable man, a visionary, a genius, an idiosyncratic master. But he's no overnight new manager bounce kind of guy. He's not, yeah, let's do the relegation fight thing. And he's not surprisingly said to have distanced himself, as I crap you not, Samuel Allardyce is a link for a return. I'm sure there'll be questions about that. But we're at all of this stage of processing everything. Let's face it, really, we're essentially at the nobody wants to go to them stage. That's where Everton are. Only the desperate, like Big Sam or Ralph Hasenhüttl. I mean, that's really bloody where we are. You know, at Mark Johnson, 0208. God, I coach soccer club, he said. and my 9-year-old players bring their stuffed animals to training at Rog Bennett. Am I next in line to coach Everton Football Club? Mark, honestly, I'll level with you. You're too qualified. And this is what it feels like to be a club who were once a great star. We were. Please know that. When I was a kid, into the 80s, we won things. We were dominant. We were a power. We are now a star flaming out into darkness. Honestly, this is like the 10 plague biblical level suffering. It really is. I do. I check Twitter all the time, expecting like the plague of boils to develop the youth academy. You know, Mashiri, our owner, briefing the press now. I'm going to sell the club for $650 million. Get on it, Mark Cuban. By the way, this is not news. Everton Football Club, just to be clear, have been quietly on the market, not so quietly, quietly on the market for the last 6 months. And I know that because American Investor Group after American Investor Group have looked at it. I've spoken to a number of them. And everything that I've heard speaking to potential American owners is what a surreal gent Mashiri is to negotiate with. Because he needs an exit. He has no choice. The sale's coming at a time when we are constructing our new stadium for about $700 million. The cost keeps going up and up and up. And he both wants and needs to sell. He has no money man behind him anymore. The sanction oligarch, Usmanov, who was mentioned yesterday with laughter in Parliament as somebody who says he severed relations with the things he owned in England before he was sanctioned, but probably hasn't. But without Usmanov, Everton, I'm not going to pot to piss in. But Mashiri also wants to maintain the perception of continued control. Dude wants to be there. At the moment, the ribbon is cut on our new stadium, which is like wanting to launch a new boat that you've already sunk. At Radio Blue in the chat wants to know, is Anthony Gordon the next Ross Barkley? But worse, I mean, we can chat about that. I mean, it's just an unfathomable thing, A, that he's still there when he was so filled with value. He was a very good player on a very bad team and scored important goals, barely in the pure plural, when we needed them. But like a great player, almost inarguably not, but he's not going like Ross to Chelsea Football Club where he's just going to be buried alive. If he does go to Newcastle, he will get minutes. What he will do with them, who knows? What do we know? We don't know a lot. Where are we now? There's potential owners around the club. In these moments, you don't exactly get your pick of greatness. Let's be candid. Everton are not exactly a wonder proposition value-wise. London clubs, always the investors' first pick. We are so far from that. And in the Northwest, commercially, we're so far behind Liverpool in our own city. Never mind the shadow of Manchester. This is bleak, I know. I believe me, I'm looking for positives in the moment. And I can't. You add on the dodgy economics of the new stadium going from proud achievement to potential albatross. And, oh, hello, darkness, my old friend. The squad is deadwood filled. Every other relegation team is rearming in January. We seem to be losing players, bleeding them. A dressing room in panic. A culture of flight, not fight. The manager search, a madness. Of course, by the way, it was right to let Frank go. That should have happened a month ago. Before the World Cup, we arguably should have got a new manager in to have time to bed his ideas. We are now at 11 defeats in 14 games, the poorest record in the Premier League over the last 3 months. We are in a tailspin. It is possible that Frank manager was a lovely man, but not a great manager. And it's also possible that he's not a good manager, but Everton, there's almost no manager that can patch over the enormous hole which has been drilled almost intentionally into the side of the club by our own owners. We are a hat on a hat on a hat of toxic football cultures. So where are we? Also, by the way, Bielsa and Allardyce. If you're thinking about Bielsa and Allardyce, there is no strategy. There is no strategy. It's like saying we might get a cat or we might get a hippopotamus. We can't decide which. Bielsa has reportedly said we've got no pace. He doesn't want that. But by the way, it almost feels that we have no plan B. It's Bielsa or bust. Number two, becoming manager of Everton right now is honestly, I spoke to John Oliver at length today. We're going to release that next week, the joyous podcast, Despite the Darkness. And we talked about how becoming manager of Everton right now is like agreeing voluntarily to become the mayor of Chernobyl the day after the nuclear reactors just melted down. This is where we are. There is zero IQ in the club. We are a small club that has for too long deluded itself as a big club. We've gone after big names, ridiculous names as players, glamorous failures. Dele Alli, yeah, we'll have a bit of him. Donny van de Beek, oh, yeah, big name. Morgan Schneiderlin, player. And we've gone after big managers. Ancelotti, when it seemed he passed his sell-by date as a big club man. Lampard, when no one else wanted him. We are a small club, and we can only become a big club again by rising with strategy, smart strategy, the Brentford way, you know, the Brighton way, a vision, a plan, carefully followed, building, not trying to buy your way to greatness haphazardly. You can't jerry-rig constant form. You cannot jerry-rig a clenched fist in the Premier League, or else you become what we are, which is a footballing cautionary tale. And I feel there will be no bottom, Sunderland style. The club want to make an appointment before Friday, they say, so the new manager will have a rare weekend without a game, a.k.a. we've already been knocked out of the FA Cup. So we're ready to go for that 4th of February masterpiece against Arsenal and Liverpool after that. God damn you. God damn you, Premier League writers. I'm going to leave this subject, on which I'm sure there'll be more to discuss, with a quote about Everton written by Jodie Peacock in the Book of Two Ways. She wrote, there are five things we need to say to people we love before they die. I forgive you. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. Goodbye. That Kay Hansonetti in the chat says, my kid listening right now says, Uncle Rog sounds mad. Oh, this is not one for the kids. This is about the true darkness of life. And Kay Hansonetti, oh, we're all going to die. Oh, to the Carabao, Manchester United at Nottingham Forest. A 3-0 romp for Erik ten Hag. What a night at the City Ground. Nottingham Forest resounding in full voice after years of misery. For that club to be Premier League and in a semi-final, their first major semi-final in 31 years. Days of wonder, days of plenty. However, Manchester United, they want this. They need this silverware too. Erik ten Hag talked about building winning cultures before the game. And all Chelsea fans will remember, we've talked about this, a lot of men in blazers. That era of Mourinho inculcated wonder. The winning habit there was the first step, winning the Carabao. That was his first trophy. He talked about how important it was to start to develop that hunger for silverware, that winning habit. And United wanted this. Scored inside 6 minutes. Marcus Rashford, half-field romp with a convoy of Forest defenders. Terrible defending, we should say. A poor man's version. Yes, the goal of the Ryan Giggs 1999 semi-final FA Cup Classic versus Arsenal. Thankfully, without the chess wig. 10 in 10 games for Marcus. Gent scored every round at the Carabao. So prolific. He's like an Erling Haaland level goal scorer. He also does a lot of good work for charity. Wout Weghorst scored his first United goal, cleaning up some Anthony-inspired slop. United never really threatened. Bruno killed off the tie effectively in the 89th minute with a third goal. United have a foot, more than a foot and a half, a foot and four toes in that Wembley final to come. Second leg will be played next week. In the other semi-final, Newcastle very much have the upper hand after a win at a very physical Southampton. Joe Linton got a hat-trick in a 1-0 win, combined a goal ruled offside with a horrific miss of the season contender before finally getting the winning goal from close range against then 10 men Southampton. Another clean sheet for Eddie Howe. The two, one game away from their first cup final since 1999 and what could be their first trophy since 1969 when they won the Fairs Cup trinket. My Lord. What a difference just a tiny bit of PIF money makes to the US men's national team. We'll take your questions in a minute, so come and be with us on the stage. The US men's national team, Avenger Assemble, were some of them anyway, for January camp tonight, 10 p.m. against Serbia on HBO Max. Traditionally, January camp, a chance to gather the players on the periphery, the bubble of the team. But the squad get together as the program really feels in limbo in the fallout of the Berhalter Arena feud, while the US soccer continues its many investigations, both footballing and not, into their, well, not their current manager, the manager who they had before his contract ran out, and the legendary player who, for reasons still unknown fully, went from lifelong friend to mortal enemy. Currently, the US has no permanent manager on the men's side. Interim Anthony Hudson will be at the helm for these next two games. Colorado Rapids fans will remember him from a brief and fairly awful spell as their coach. First of two friendlies tonight in Carson, California. Hudson told the press, "It's a shame for everyone who's involved, players, staff, Greg, everyone is affected by it. It's, quote, not a nice situation." That is the cloud that hangs over the game that could, that should, honestly, be very quickly dealt with so that we can draw a line and move on. It really does suck that this new cycle, like the last one, begins with stasis, a frittering of momentum. It all feels so self-inflicted and with swifter action. Honestly, it feels unnecessary. Instead, we list in as a program really in stasis. Young squad, 13 players able to make their debuts for the US men's national team. Some real things to be excited about. Paxton Aronson, brother of Brendan, now of Eintracht Frankfurt. Be magic to watch that gent. Gaga Slanina, 18-year-old goalkeeping sensation who is at Chelsea. Oh, Brendan Vasquez, the MLS striker many believe should have been in Jesus Ferreira's spot in the World Cup proper. He will get his shot, as does Alejandro Zendejas, the attacker from Club America, born in Mexico, came of age in El Paso, actually played for Mexico. It'll be magic to watch him tonight. Game takes place against a backdrop of real change for so many of our best players. Fascinating as the transfer window grinds down to the last day of the month. At club level, rumours link Christian Pulisic, still injured. But as Todd Boehly stockpiles attacking talent, a move to AC Milan is heavily linked, which would reunite him with Beard Daddy Olivier Giroud. Can you just imagine Olivier picking him up at the airport? It'd be so emotional. Opportunity for a fresh start that we like to believe he doesn't need, but could undoubtedly do with Weston McKennie. How excited are you about this? America reportedly has agreed to terms personally with Leeds United. This is not a drill. This is now in Juventus's hands, in Leeds United's hands. Not a done deal yet, but that would be a third baby eagle on one club team in the Premier League. Jesse Marsh seems determined to manage the US men's national team one way or another, even if it's just at club level. Let's discuss about what you think about that. Weston going to trade the finger hand purse gesture for the two-fingered reverse V in no time. This bloody better go well, or else American accents are not going to be welcome in Leeds. Oh, for generations. And then today, Gio Reyna. Gio bloody Reyna, second straight match. This one, the Mainz Dortmund Jurgen Klopp Memorial Derby. Gio Reyna, our prince of pettiness, strolled onto the field as substitute. And yet again, second game on the run, summoned a late winner, this one in the 94th minute, off set pieces. I didn't know you could score off them. Again, he cupped his ear. Celebration analysts can dig into what he was saying, who it was to. Was he taking out Lallis this time? We do not know. But a quick word on Gio, because I'm sure there'll be questions about him. But there's been a wave. A wave is slight exaggeration, but there's been a number of older pundits who have, you know, furnished some kind of an outcry. You know, cut out this petulant behaviour, young gun. And I want to say, there's an element of change to this Gio story that I don't think is getting enough discussion, which is, you know, our understanding of American talent, I do believe, or some of the pundits' understanding, It's really out of date. You know, the all for one, the one for all, the collective spirit of the 90s. It has been replaced because fundamentally our players are now actually elite. They play in Europe. European footballers, they play at the top of the European game. And a secret, which you already know, which is not a secret, elite football players are pampered. They are pampered and they do have leverage and they do fight for image rights and they fight for their careers as individuals. And an underreported new dimension to this, this is honestly the first time a US men's national team has a lot of bona fide stars. We've dealt with that on the women's team for a while. You know, there's been Alex, there's been Megan. You know, you can name them as well as I can. But the men, for the first time, active like that ahead of the tournament, negotiating through their agents, who would be on the magazine covers, Esquire, GQ, whatever. Would they be solo? Would they be in a group? Who are the other players in the group? Are they, you know, do they deserve to be on their level? This is all new terrain for the US national team. By the way, this is not new terrain for the England national team. It's not new terrain for Germany or France. This is how elite football is. It's filled with ego and petulance. That is modern sports. And honestly, part of this, the demanding, oh, be just stop, young one, know your place. We need a coach who can manage elite European footballing egos. That's honestly what it's where we are right now. It's different to the old days. You know, when Alexi played at Padua in the Serie A, which is fantastic. It is very different from those days. And I'm not defending Gio's behaviour in practice early on at the World Cup. But the more European reared our young talents are, the less we can do an American-only experienced coach, and the more we need a man manager who knows how to manage ego. That ultimately is the reality. The more European elite our gents become, the more ego they will have, and we have to learn to deal with it. Oh. To the Q&A portion of the show. It is so good to be here. I am so excited to hear your questions, your thoughts. Got a lot of ground to cover. If you have a question, we do have a full stage. Be patient. We will bring you up when the stage empties. But for now, request the call in. We'll move you to stage. Stay muted until we call your name. Then point the little red button atop your avatar, which will unmute you with your finger, which is on the end of your hand. And come be with us. First question, it's got to be, after I name-checked her and her beautiful child, oh, Akke Hansinetti, oh, let me apologize to your kid in person.
Oh, no, Raj. You know that TJ loves Uncle Raj, so he does not need your apology. But I did want to ask you about that Ringer question, or Ringer article that came out, I guess it was yesterday, I can't remember, yesterday or Monday, and forgive me for forgetting the name of the writer, but the Ringer article that basically said the United States men's national team job, in addition to being unsavory for all of the publicity reasons we have right now, we've got issues also with what we could pay people and the fact that there just aren't a whole lot of people interested in it. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that article, you know, whether to take it with a grain of salt, whether we should really be drowning ourselves in our third first bud of the day or something like that. But it was not the most exciting article to read, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it.
Oh, you're referring to the Leander Schellekens Ringer piece, which ran.
Yes, that is his earlier. Name.
Look, there was parts of the story that I agree with. There's parts I don't. And Leander, as memory serves right, talked about how the lack of competitive football, we don't have to qualify. So there's not really, you know, there's not that much for an international manager. The big point for an international manager, and this is very true, this is incredibly true, and Leander made it really well, is that international management used to be a deeply respected, you know, the best managers really cut their teeth at the international level. But the more the club game kind of came to the forefront and then some, you know, this modern Champions League era, the modern Premier League era, the modern Bundesliga era, where the manager has become has become utterly just so dominant. You know, even now, when we think about matchups in the Premier League, it's Klopp against Pep. It's, you know, Mourinho returns to it. The management storyline has become so immense. Our obsession with managers. Antonio Conte said last week, you're almost too obsessed in the English-speaking world with managers. You know, in Italy, they have directors of football that represent the club and give press conferences. The medical staff will talk about fitness. We're manager, manager, manager. And with that has come just high-performance demands, high-performance pressures, and enormous amounts of money to be made in the club game. And with those pressures, with that money, with that spotlight, the elite, everybody wants to coach in the Premier League. I mean, that's the future of elite coaching. Wasn't that way even like 8 years ago, the Bundesliga, La Liga. But now the Premier League, as it has poached the great players, is poaching almost every great manager. You see, even Wolves in a relegation battle are able to be enticing enough for Lopetegui to swan over. So up and down, the managerial depth in the Premier League is just elite. And then you get to international football as the seesaw is tilted against international football. International football over the last decade has really become the purview for the managers who can't manage. You know, that old saying, if you can do it, do it. If you can't do it, teach, which I think is really a cruel moniker. You know, here we love teachers in every regard and they're so grateful to them. But that old cliche, which is wrong in that front, is probably right in the international management realm. If you can do it, manage. If you can't manage, become an international manager. Hence you have Roberto Martinez, who is a wonderful man, an incredible human being, who, you know, just completely and utterly stalled out at Everton, couldn't defend, got Wigan, ultimately relegated, flailed, really found out at the club level, became for a prolonged period the manager of Belgium's golden generation, underperformed recklessly, negligently almost, tactically, and then became immediately unemployed for minutes before he was given the Portugal job. That is the greatest way to exemplify international football. There were not many managers, and Leander makes this point, at the World Cup who were like, oh my God, he's an elite manager. I want him. However, this is the big however, and this is why I would say the US job is actually quite coveted. There's one technicality. It's not clear to me, and I'm not able to fully get a straight answer, whether the male manager has to be paid in the new equality deal exactly the same amount as the female manager of the US women's national team. If that is the case, then that's going to definitely change the possibility of who can be attracted to this job. But the big pull for the US job and international management, essentially, it is for the aging manager. It's for the manager who's tired of the club grind, the club pressure, the every week agony, you see already, like one, two games has become a tailspin. He should be fired. One game back is, they're back in the swing of things. Many managers cannot, you know, there becomes a point where that stress, and you see it with even Pep when he's winning, is the mania, the pressure, Klopp, the agony he's going through now. There is a moment, Klopp talked about it this week on Michael Calvin's podcast. He can't see doing this forever. He will not be an old manager. This is not a life that's sustainable. When it's not sustainable, can become an international manager. You speak to a couple of the international managers and they do laugh. You know, it's great. You get, you know, you play, you watch a lot of football, you travel around, you play a lot of golf. And then every so often, you have to come together and coach a team that come together for a week. It's almost like the difference between full-time, all-consuming, high-pressure job. International management is more like a consultancy, or almost like being a board member of a public company. But here's the thing. The US manager job is incredibly enthralling because to be the manager of the US team, when the World Cup is coming to the United States and Canada and Mexico in 2026 means you will be not just the manager, you'll be the figurehead. You'll be the mouthpiece. You will be sitting there on Colbert, if there still is a Colbert show in 2026. You'll be on 60 Minutes. You'll be the face of this team commercially in this moment of deep change in America as we finally go over the top in becoming a normal footballing nation. Put it this way, there's so much money to be made. In the same way as so many of these young players like Yunus Musa are like, yes, I'm going to choose to play for the United States. You know, the players want to play for us. Yes, they feel American, but yes, they also are savvy. They see the commercial opportunity in this nation with this 2026 World Cup coming. And so for that reason and that reason alone, there is the possibility of getting a name that would make us dream, that would make us soar. Who that is, we can discuss. And again, big, big apologies to your kid. It's the Everton talking. It's not Rog. It's the Everton talking. God bless. Come on up at Dinkin Flicker. Tell us where you are and what's your question.
Rog, thank you so much. First off, my name is Matt. I'm calling from Cary, North Carolina. I want to thank you for your voice. I don't know if it's the sophisticated insights or the Liverpool drawl, but I found you via the Pod Save America crossovers, Pod Save the World, rather, and fell hard and fast for you, you beautiful man.
Oh, thank you. So, that makes me so happy. I've got to tell you, the World Cup was such a boon, such a, you know, we have been surging as football surges, but the World Cup was just a wonder for us at Men in Blazers as we took it on by sea, by land, by air. And it fills me with joy to welcome so many new fans of the game, so many new fans of Men in Blazers, and so many, you know, Tommy Vitor fans. It really does. What a noble and remarkable bloke to partner with. At Dinkin Flicker, you are an incredible human being. And it is wonderful to have you here today.
Thank you, sir. It's been a blast, and you have my thanks for bringing me in. So, and I'm calling from, like I said, Cary, North Carolina, home of my favorite club of the NWSL, with undoubtedly the greatest name in all of sport. Courage. So we're hoping to get you out here. Come do a live in Raleigh or Durham or somewhere. We'd love to have you. But on to my question.
I'm gonna eat all that Beasley's fried chicken.
Oh, you already know it, my friend. Absolutely. All right. Well, here it is. It's about the men's national team. And I do position you as, you know, something of a beacon, a moral authority, as I learn the complexities and the nuances of the game, and particularly the social and geopolitical intersections that arise, especially with tournaments like the World Cup. So what I want to know is it fair to be disappointed in our men of the U.S. men's national team after this World Cup, not for their performance on the pitch, but for the deafening silence on any of the numerous human rights violations that enabled the recent tournament? Captain Adams gave us a truly remarkable soundbite during that famous press conference. But that makes it even more sad to me to know what we're capable of and see so little in the way of using their platforms to call attention and to advocate for change. Our women, the fierce and courageous and groundbreaking women of our national team organization, certainly would have done better and more if they would have even accepted such a bid to a tournament in such a place. So I ask again, is it fair to want more from our men? What am I missing? Why could others do it and not ours? Big love and courage to you and yours, sir.
Oh, mate, what a question. What a question. What a moment. I've been thinking about this a lot. As I said earlier, I filmed with John Oliver today for a special, which will be a television show imminently, and also an extended podcast. And it was a beautiful conversation. And we talked at length about this, and we went through the steps of this World Cup, the anticipation going into it, the Australian video, the really poignant video the Australian national team made, really articulate, really intelligently done. The Danish team with their shirts of protest, the German team putting their hands over their mouth before the game, and then the armband wars. The armband wars was really difficult. I still feel like we don't fully know. If you don't remember, like England and a bunch of the European teams were meant to wear an armband that was meant to support the idea of one love. It was a glancing blow at protest, I would say, a fleeting gesture at protest. And we still don't know what happened in that. If there was a negotiation between them and FIFA, FIFA essentially wouldn't okay them wearing it, didn't respond to them for weeks and weeks and weeks once they said they were going to do it. And then the night before, all we know is they said whoever wore it would get a yellow card. But we don't really know what was said. And it kind of crushed all protest, as did the fact that Germany put their hands over their mouth and lost the game. It's so silly. This is how protest and morality works. That once they lost, they crapped the bed. They got eviscerated by their nation, half of whom said, if you really felt that way, you shouldn't have played the bloody tournament. You shouldn't have gone there in the first place. And then the other half said, yeah, you protest and then you lose, you bunch of morons. So they got it from both ends. And as the tournament kicked into gear and the, you know, just the messy odyssey began, yeah, the sad truth is that the political, the geopolitical, the protest was snuffed out and we got Messi and we got Morocco mothers and we got Salt Bay. And it was an agony and it was bloody disappointing. Because ultimately, can this happen again? That was really the stakes of protest. And the reality is, yes. And any nation who is looking to sports wash their human rights abuses will look at that and be like, yeah, that worked for Qatar. We want some of that. And then you look at the US men in that context. Number one, and I'm not going to excuse them, I would have liked to have heard more. You know, they talked a lot about how Greg had empowered this team to really think through the issues. They talked a lot about wanting to be the change. I think they even had that as one of their warm-up jackets, be the change. And so I'm only saying that not to mock it, but when you say that, be the change, and then it's followed by not silence, to be clear, because they did do, as memory serves me right, you know, if US soccer were on this call, they would say, we flew... any US soccer event, we flew the gay pride flag, and they did what every team did, which is a bit rote ultimately and a bit performative. They had what we were told were workers to come and have a kick around, which achieved very little. They had LGBTQ flags at US soccer facilities, which is not nothing. But could they have done more? Could they have spoken out? When you say be the change and then you are utterly silent, here's two things I think that hem them in. And the first is that they were very bloody young. This is a very young team, which I'm not saying is an excuse at all. But when you are very young, and particularly in that team, and I'm sorry to get footballing on you, when, you know, ultimately you're asking about morality, but this is the reality of it, is when footballers are young, and particularly in that team, remember, there were players who were stalwarts, pillars of the team, who they'd seen get wiped out. Zach Steffen, the king, one minute, not even invited to the party, ultimately. They'd seen veteran human beings who were quite mouthy in early camps, just disinvited completely. John Brooks, for instance. You know, Tim Ream, who, you know, in a podcast that we've just released, talked about how he and Greg, you know, had a fallout and it led to his exile for a long period of time. So in those situations, you kind of keep your head down and you don't make waves, because all you want to do is play bloody World Cup football. So I think on an individual level, there was like just I'm going to keep my head down. I'm not going to make trouble. I'm not going to be the one to step up. And then number two, and this is really complicated, and I'd love, I've talked to Tommy about doing more on this. The World Cup is now in the United States of America. And I think some of the fear amongst the Western nations about speaking out in this instance was that they knew that they're setting an example for when they're hosting whatever the hell they're going to host. And my God, every team from now on is, every nation from now on is under the microscope and is set. When we invite people to the United States, and we talked about this in episode 7 of World Corrupt, you know, you can go back and listen, that we've got to be prepared for the world to come to the United States and criticize so many things about our politics. We will not on our culture. You know, every part of our culture wars, every part of our political wars, and I don't need to name them now. They're very. If any of you have read the front pages, you know where we are. I mean, there's foreign journalists already talking about the number of mass shootings in the United States. So there is going to be an example has been set in Qatar, which will now be carried on. Tariq Panja referenced that specifically, the number of shootings. We are going to have a mirror held back to us now. And I think that held us in check a little bit. We did not want to like charge in there and be the loudest voice and then invite essentially repercussion loud voices in 4 years' time. I don't agree with it. I don't love it. But I'll say this, that I do take solace from looking at the Iran game. And I think we all should. The way our boys comforted the Iranian players who were distraught in a dark geopolitical nightmare of their own at the final whistle on the field, where there's no PR or marketing intervention or discussion about, quote, messaging. That was very real to me. That was not footballers calculating their next PR move. That was humanity and morality laid bare. And I really admired that. I've said enough about Tyler and how much I admired that. I cannot tell you how difficult that was. Maybe podcasting with me for 9 months before the World Cup, working with an arsehole, Roger Bennett, had prepared him and given him the media training he needed. But I cannot overestimate how incredible that was, how that played morally. Particularly, I was once English, as you know. Americans are always cocky, aggressive, angry. To see him so humble, yet confident and poised, that was an incredible America and an incredible moment. So we can't give them a pass. But I do believe they showed their moral fiber in those moments, those split-second decisions. And that spoke volumes in a moment of triumph and victory for them. That would be it. Ultimately, John Oliver, I'll leave you with this one. John Oliver told us that the original sin here is not the players. The original sin is FIFA's. And we cannot lose sight of that. You're a beautiful man at Dinkin Flicker. I'm so grateful for you coming on and joining us and finding joy in our crap. There's so much brilliant football as we come down to the stretch of the Premier League season. But if you're a Premier League neutral who wants a little bit of that title race excitement, check out Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app, where you can get in on the action and win up to 100 times your cash. Prize Picks is the best way to get action on sports in more than 30 states across our nation, including California, Texas, and Georgia. You just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projected stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. You can also mix and match players from several leagues across the globe, as well as other sports like basketball and hockey. That's right, Prize Picks. Essentially a utopia where polysport action can live and breathe. I'm talking Washington Caps, Everton, and Chicago Bulls action all at once in the face. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match up to $100. That's promo code MIB. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy. It's Rog here to tell you about a product that I simply adore. It's been a long time staple in the Bennett refrigerator, Stoke Cold Brew Coffee. Always bold, always smooth. Yes, that is the very same Stoke as in the mighty Wrexham Fortress, known as the Stoke Kairas or the Stoke Racecourse, Wrexham AFC's home. They support it. They support football, which is just one great reason to love this coffee. It is my go-to enjoy during the football calendar, essentially the opposite of Everton. And you can check out their full lineup of 48 ounce cold brew products, something for everybody, from light to dark roast to seasonal favorites in a refrigerated multi-serve format. I tell you this as someone whose blood type is now officially Stoke Espresso Blend. Have the coffee house experience in the comfort of your own home and do it now. Stoke Cold Brew Coffee, and be sure to follow Wrexham AFC. Big love to all at Stoke. Courage. At Joe. Oh, come on, you beautiful human being. Come on up. Remind us where you are and what's your question.
Yeah, Rog, here in Dallas, Texas. I had two questions. One, Man U, are they back? And what would you think that was the turning point for them? And then after that, I have an Everton question.
Okay. The Manchester United thing is simple. I mean, back, I don't know. I mean, the Sir Alex, Manchester United, I was talking and thinking about them today. I mean, they lived in a very different footballing ecosphere where, I think I just made a word up there, where essentially they were the first team to realise, you know, Liverpool were the gold standard of football when I was really a kid in the 70s. They won everything, often. And they were a very proud club, a very traditional club. I remember when the internet started, talking to someone at Liverpool Football Club, I can't remember, it was like someone in the comms department, they were proud that they didn't have a website. They're like, oh, we don't do that at Liverpool Football Club. None of that. None of that internet thingy-majiggy. It's not who we are. Manchester United, however, were very, very different. They took the beginning of the Premier League. They were the quickest club to realise that the Premier League and the vast broadcast deals, which had never been done before. Remember, English football when I was a kid was not on television by and large. They were terrified that if they started to broadcast live games, no one would go to the other games. We're such a tiny island that they thought, broadcast the games live, no one's going to go to the game anymore. So we had very few live games. That's why the FA Cup was so massive in England, because the FA Cup was broadcast live, one game every round. But Manchester United realised that as soon as the Premier League came in and they did TV deals with the rest of Europe and they did TV deals with Africa and then China and Australia and Asia, that they could essentially start to be a global brand. And Manchester United, when everybody else and Liverpool were the gold standard, and remember, they had that attitude, we don't do websites here at Liverpool Football Club, lad. Manchester United went to every region and built a massive patchwork strategy of having a brand sponsor for banks, airways, credit cards, all the way down to, and we always laugh about them, but it's real, tractor engines, the official Manchester United tractor engine, the official potato snack, the official wine in every single region. And they turned their brand into a massive cash machine. And so suddenly, out of nowhere, Manchester United, this is before the oligarchs, this is before a state investment in Manchester City and Newcastle. Manchester United suddenly just had money after money, piles of cash that no one else could touch. Every other club is working off, we've got a full stadium again, lads, we've done everything we can do. That's how you make money in football. Manchester United were like, no, they rewrote the school, the playbook, and essentially turned the Premier League broadcast rights into a massive global ATM. And they were dominant. I mean, they were so unbelievably dominant. I was laughing with John Oliver again today, that they were so dominant, they were so omnipotent, they won everything, always. I used to joke that if Manchester United played in 11 in which Vlad the Impaler and Ivan the Terrible and nine other awful human beings from history were playing on the other team, I'd be like, come on, Ivan the Terrible, get stuck in, lad. That's how much I despise Manchester United. I despise them because they won everything. So a long answer to say, are they back? Are they back to that? No. But are they back as a true force? Are they back as a club with a vision, a strategy in recruitment and scouting discipline? You know, are they doing what Everton did in a minor way, but it's a great agony, just buying players that were flavour of the month, an exquisite corpse of a squad, hiring and firing managers, total chaos. Yes, that is over. And so Manchester United, and just remind me, Josimar, are you a United fan?
No, I'm a Chelsea fan, and you're kind of scaring me now that you're saying just buying players, flavour of the month.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, Chelsea has read, Todd Boehly is reading a lot about football, but he's mostly reading from the Manchester United, the early Glazer years. I mean, it's uncalibrated, headless madness. Let's just get big bold swings. It's that Chelsea is a madness, but Manchester United, are they back? Erik ten Hag. I was remembering today when he started, we felt sorry for him. We felt he was doomed before he kicked a ball, struggled in his first game. We laughed. He looked lost. He has laughed back and then some, just seeing off it masterfully. Ronaldo exercising that wound and building a culture, the impact of Casemiro, the professionalism, just the fierceness that he's brought into that squad, the man management of Rashford. Even Aaron Wan-Bissaka is suddenly a tasty player. Luke Shaw enjoying his football again. So I wouldn't say they are back to peak Manchester United, where they were going to roll over everybody and essentially treat the Premier League like Manchester City currently treat the Premier League. But are they back as a true top four contender who can aspire to win the title and make huge noise in the true European competition rather than pretend they're happy to win the Europa League or lesser? Yes. I mean, it certainly looks that way. And I'll be candid. I think the Premier League's all the better for it. What was your West Ham question, Jossima?
No, it's actually an Everton question. Now, my dad taught me not to kick a Raj when he's down, but how fearful are you that if they do drop, that they don't come back? I've seen the Sunderland documentary on Netflix, and you see the changes, the cuts that they have to make, not just on the field, but even in the back office, the kitchen staff, the fitness staff, the even facilities being cut down. How fearful is that, you know, you being a fan of them?
God, you're asking a great question, and it is so unbelievably painful. The reality is, it feels like we've been relegated now. That's what the past 48 hours have felt like. Yesterday was an agony just of everything, just everything imploding, everything, the squad, the want-aways, the humiliation of Dan Juma, utter, complete humiliation. The managerial ridiculousness. I mean, there is no strategy. This is not an owner who, I mean, it's been clear Frank Lampard has been failing for a long time. It is very clear that he was probably going to be let go. To have no plan to replace him, to be flailing in this moment, to watch other teams in the relegation zone buy new strikers, new talent. We don't have the money. Clearly don't have the money to buy anything. And we are flailing. We are falling. We are trying to get a handhold as we fall off the cliff. And there's nothing to grasp. There's nothing to grasp. And what do we have? We're in the process of appointing a seventh manager, is it, in 6 years? We have no balance. If you watch Everton every week between attack and defence, utterly susceptible to the counter, as Bielsa is alleged to have said when he reviewed Everton, the players, the squad, far too slow, no real style. You know, I watch mid-table teams. I watched Wolves with my kid the other day. They make passes in the final third that look so inventive, so groundbreaking if you watch Everton week in, week out. We are playing football in gruel. So the current bookies' favourites, Marcelo Bielsa, 5-4. There's no way he's coming. Sean Dyche, 9-4. The owners have said they don't want him. I would bite your arm off for Sean Dyche. Ralph bloody Hasenhüttl. I mean, it's like I'm being mocked and derided by past comments. 7-1 to come. And then Sam Allardyce coming back, threatening to take the pies that he left in the freezer at the training ground and finish them off. There is one thing about Bielsa. When I interviewed him, he said football is about bringing joy to those who find joy hard to find. You know, right now, we're the exact opposite of that, the football we play. But Everton, it is hard to find joy. Proud fan base, magical fan base, devoted fan base, massive financial fair play problems after blowing 700 million plus on you know, these wasters, incompetence, Cenk Tosun, Theo Walcott, Davy Klaassen, Morgan Schneiderlin, Andre Gomez, Jean-Philippe Aubameyang, stadium problems, massive financial problems. That's going to turn into an albatross. A squad full of deadwood, no coherent club strategy for scouting, recruitment or tactical vision, and really a devoted fan base left to reel in agony as they recoil in horror of reliving the experience of how exactly we got here. So to tell you the honest truth, and thanks to your dad for his kindness, the honest reality, my wife said this, it feels the past 48 hours as if we've been relegated. She said, oh, at least you've ripped the Band-Aid off. This is my own wife said to me yesterday. She said, you've ripped the Band-Aid off. You've spared yourself the agony of a slow decline. Don't you feel better for getting out of the way? But the honest truth is I don't. There's so much football left to sit through. It's going to be a slow, gruesome agony. And I very much fear, that this is relegation is most certainly not the bottom for this owner, who is an idiot, who is financially now bereft, has no strategy, no football IQ, no football IQ whatsoever, and has taken this beautiful thing, which is so beautiful to so many. That's what hurts, watching the fans. This is meaning. This is generational connectivity. This is joy to so many of them. Has taken it and utterly, utterly just left it like Natalie in Bruglia lying naked and in agony, shivering on the bloody floor. You're a beautiful human being. Love to your dad. Quick one from at West Ham sufferer. Come on up. Finish us off. Bring us a tiny bit of joy. You've got to unmute West Ham sufferer. I love your name there. Bite your arm off to suffer like West Ham. If you can't unmute, I do actually have your question. I believe you want to know, what books am I reading? If you can unmute and come and be, you just got to push the little button with your finger there, the little red button. Going to give you one more second. Oh, what book am I reading? I'm reading a ton of books at the moment. The worse the football, the more painful the football is, the more I read, to be candid. I read through the night to try and not think about Everton Football Club. And right now, this very second, I'm on a massive slow horses kick. I've talked about, I think, the show. What's it on? Is it on Apple? I can't even bloody remember. I can't even give it the plug that it deserves. But it's a masterpiece of television. It's just the role Gary Oldman was born to play. I love the series. There's two of them so bloody much that I'm actually reading the books by Mick Herron, who's a fantastic and remarkable writer. And even if you have, even if you've loved the television series, get the books, because just the images of life and of London and really of human, the human condition that Mick Herron conjures, I'd recommend them massively. And then the book that I love that I've just finished, and I read it again immediately. I enjoyed it so bloody much. Bourneville by Jonathan Coe. It's set in Birmingham. It's multi-generational. It's a history of a family. It's really a modern British history, a post-war, a pre- and post-war history. It's so unbelievably moving. I read a lot, and this book has just stayed with me in every regard. If you are a mild Anglophile, and many of you love the football, do love that stuff, get stuck in. Buy yourself from Bourneville by Jonathan Coe, and subscribe to our newsletter. I always try and bang the book that I'm reading at the end of that. That is a lovely way, an elevated way to finish this time together. Not a huge number of questions about tonight, but we will break down the game and we'll drop a pod in the morning for whatever crumbs we are fed of US joy. I do bloody hope that we share. We'll be back with WGFOP, the weekend preview on Friday. We will revel in your arms again. I want to end with a Jägermeister toast by raising a shot of Jägermeister, this bolt of human emotion in a shot glass, to a quote from a gent I do believe we'll see tonight, Paul Areola, once seen as a Berhalter favourite, who was then axed for the final World Cup squad in agony. And he's now back on the grind in January camp. And he said this to the Washington Post when he explained why he came back after that pain. He said, I hopefully one day will have children, and I want them to be able to look at their father and say he literally had the failure of his dreams, and he chose to respond by getting up and still being willing to be part of the program and continuing to play. Beautiful from Paul, honest and courageous. To you, Paul, I raise this shot. Godspeed. Just a reminder about the content we've got coming out, Men in Blazers World Headquarters this week. We've just dropped a beautiful, beautiful, God, I love this man, Tim Ream podcast, presented by the GFOPs at Camarena Tequila, the most awarded tequila. What a human wonder he is. Proof that the fountain of youth is one part Mississippi River, one part Thames. Get on our pod feed. Please share that one. There's a lot of life in that. Within the last hour, a special YouTube version of the interview went up on our YouTube channel. Get on that. Subscribe. We have a really warm and joyous Bukayo Saka interview up there right now. Arsenal fans raising this Jägermeister to you. Something to look out for next week. John Oliver, pod special. Fresh take this morning. Don't want to hype it up too much, but man, God, it's a must listen. Big love. You made me feel better. A tiny bit better. I've got to go. My kids are all sobbing. Thinking about the Arsenal game, Everton Arsenal, February 4th. There is no hope. Godspeed, GFOPs. This is Rod saying big love and courage. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.